Welcome to the world of thoroughbred racing on the Equisport Radio Network.
Allidare's got a lead. Allidare put ahead in front, right in the middle of the stretch. It's Allidare and Affirmed battling back along the inside. We'll test these two to the wire. Affirmed under a left-hand whip. Allidare on the outside driving. Affirmed and Allidare heads apart. Affirmed's got a nose in front as they come onto the wire.
Join our host, Les Salzman, and his team as they go behind the scene to cover the inside stories and history of the international racing scene.
And down the stretch they come. On the outside, it's Sunday Silence. Easy Goer with Pat Day. Back to challenge. Heads apart. Easy Goer on the inside with a slight lead. On the outside, Sunday Silence. The rest of them far back. Here's the finish of the Preakness. Sunday Silence and Easy Goer. Photo finish. Noses apart.
Get ready for some great interviews and fast-paced action.
She's starting to pick them off, those Zenyatta going to hook to the outside. Meanwhile, it's Colonel John, Summer Bird in the red cap. And Zenyatta's come to the outside. Zenyatta coming flying on the grandstand side. Gio Ponti on the inside. Summer Bird is right there. This is unbelievable. Zenyatta, what a performance. One wheel.
And now, your host, Les Salzman.
Into the stretch and do it with style is in front. Now by a length, Private Treasure on the rail second. Garden Gal is third with Till Forbid fourth. Down the stretch, it's do it with style. Private Treasure, it's between those two, then Garden Gal and Till Forbid. Nearing the wire, do it with style and Private Treasure.
Gary, does that ring a bell?
Yeah, man, it was like yesterday.
it's funny. And by the way, everybody, this is Les Salzman on the Equisport Radio Network, and my very, very special guest and good friend, Gary Contessa. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for fitting us in, because I did not realize you had a horse in exactly at the time the show was going on.
Don't worry. I got two assistant trainers, and they can put a saddle on one. So we're okay.
Okay, good. And I appreciate it. Gary, first of all, I know you had a little surgery last week. Everything's good?
Yeah, it's all good.
Excellent.
All good. Just good. a little, something I've been putting off forever. So I had, and I'm going to tell you, at my age, I had my wisdom teeth pulled. And they weren't exposed, so it was a real mess. And boy, did it threw me off tilt for a couple of days, that's for sure.
But you had plenty of ice cream, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the upside to the deal.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking, Gary, the other day, I was looking at your record, and we both started training right around the same time. And, you know, back in the day when you'd send horses down to Atlantic City and everything else, it was great.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize you've won over 2,300 races.
Yeah. It's amazing. I often said to myself, Rick Lang called me when I was three wins away from 2,000, and I honestly wished he hadn't, because then it took forever to get those last three and get to 2,000. But I thought to myself, geez, I must have been in somewhere in New Jersey when I won 1,000. Like, in those days, they never made a big deal out of that, and I'm glad they make a big deal out of it now. It's a good thing. A lot of effort.
It is. And, you know, and people like yourself who – work hard every single day. I mean, for you and your staff, you know, there's not a lot. Well, there's glamour, but not the top of the line glamour that some of these guys are getting. And you're working really hard, and you're winning with claiming horses and allowance horses. And if nobody knows it, you're under the radar. And now at least people see it.
Right. Well, you know, it's hard racing in New York year round. You really got to have the right horses, because right now, if you take a look at my record today, I'm having an abysmal meet at Belmont. But coming into this meet, I know I have 45 horses and 38 of them are two-year-olds. And what happens to you during the bigger meets? Those two-year-olds are going to be very good when we get to Aqueduct. But it seems like no matter what you do, every time you put a two-year-old in New York, somebody's got a $1 million one they're throwing at you, a $2 million one. I mean, somebody always seems to have a better one. And right now I'm relying on two-year-olds to get me through this meet. And it's just, I've got a lot of horses knocking at the door, but they just can't pass that last horse.
Well, you're right. And I think that is exactly what's happened in New York. There's always that one. You know, you go in there and your horse is training really well. And then you look at the entries and there's that one that you say, geez, I'm going to have to be at my best and better to get the job done. But when, like you said, when you go to Aqueduct, things change a little bit.
Yeah, the your big trainers are going to take their best horses to Florida, and I would help support that 100%. They would go sooner rather than later.
But for your owners that stay in New York, with the purses being so good for babies right now, it kind of pays to stay there.
Oh, yeah. And we've had some success. We won 3 baby races at Saratoga, but then I'm looking at the troops and geez, they just don't write. I have a bunch that I pay $20,000-$30,000 for. You know, you need a claimer for those, that type in New York, and they're just barely starting to write those kind of races now. So things are going to get better for us.
Now you've always had a great eye for 2-year-olds. Matter of fact, I've always admired that you've been able to buy those $20,000-$40,000 2-year-olds and get the job done and make them profitable for your owners. Now, did you get the eye for the 2-year-olds when you were working way back when at Harborview?
Well, that certainly helped. And the interesting thing was I worked for Jimmy Pacu. That was my first job on the racetrack. And Jimmy Pacu trained for Marge Schott and for Sandra Payson. So we would get, I mean, we had Willow Hour. We won the Travers with Willow Hour. We had him as a 2-year-old. We had Herschel Walker. We got Ride Sally early before Mrs. Payson fell out with Jimmy and went to Nick Zito. I mean, every year he would have some really nice babies. And I love Jimmy, but I was the assistant trainer and I was a good soldier. But I always thought that we sent too many of them home and that there has to be a better way. And I think if I have a strength, it's keeping 2-year-olds sound, which is really the hardest part of the whole thing. 2-year-olds are delicate. 2-year-olds are like high school kids. And you're not going to stick a needle in the quarterback's ankle when he's in high school to get him out there for the next game. You're just not going to do it. You're going to let a kid heal. So I kind of pride myself in seeing things way before they become major problems. And fixing them.
You know, and looking at your record over the years, your starts per starter is very high.
Yeah.
And that's difficult in New York because, as you said, it's a year round circuit that's really kind of pounding. So how do you get that feel? How does that come to you? Because you're not 32nd generation horseman. You know, how did this come to you?
My father was an absentee, and my mother drove a school bus. But it's something that I was always enamored with. And when we were kids, my mother never said, where are you going when you went out the door? Just, you better be home by dinner. So I'd get on my bicycle at 7 o'clock in the morning and ride to Roosevelt Raceway and stand there offering to work with the horses for free. And the amazing thing, there was always somebody that wanted to pay me nothing and let me work on their horses. So I learned with harness horses because it was all I could do. And on Saturdays and Sundays, I would ride my bicycle along the Southern State Parkway on the grass from Merrick to Hempstead Lake State Park. And that lady, if I cleaned all 50 stalls, she'd let me have 2-hour ride time. So I'd clean all the stalls on Saturday, all the stalls on Sunday, and then go for a ride. They had a beautiful horse pass through the woods and everything. It was a great place, Hempstead Lake State Park. But I had to knock out 50 stalls in order to ride for free.
So you were horse sick from birth.
I was. The first time I got dumped on my head was at the 1963 World's Fair in Flushing. I was 5 and a half years old, and I wanted a pony ride. And the guy, you know, some schlep is taking care of the ponies. He puts me up on the pony, and the pony goes into a bucking fit. I don't know if he had the girth too tight or what. I went airborne, and I had this feisty old grandmother from Germany, and she was, like, really really opinionated. And I was crying and everything. She said, "You get back on that horse." And I said, "No way. I ain't getting back on that horse." She said, "You get back on that horse or I'm going to stick you on that horse." And you know what? If she didn't make me get back on that horse at age five, I might not be here talking to you today, because I might have developed a fear of horses. So that I owe a lot to my feisty German grandmother who made me get back on that horse, because I fell hard.
You know, it's funny. We've known each other for, 40 some odd years. But and I never knew this about you. I started with standardbreds as well. And I think that when you're working with the standardbreds, you know, you get a different, because their needs are different than a lot of the regular thoroughbred needs, you get a different feel. But also, when I was a kid, when I started riding, my grandmother used to take me to ride. And if it was cold, whatever, and I was like the same age as you, you got to get on the horse. So it's interesting that we both have similar backgrounds. Now, when you were with the standardbreds, did you get behind any? Did you drive?
Oh, yeah. Or? Are you kidding? Those guys, once they realized I could, they let me drive them because they didn't want to be bothered. Half of them would go home and say, "Okay, listen, they jog these 3-4 miles a piece, and you know, you can tie them to the wall, you can give them a bath, everything else. You know, we cooled them out. There wasn't like hot walkers and all that stuff at the harness track, as you well know." So yeah, and the interesting thing was when I went to elementary school. I'm going to say junior high school, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. We had a truant officer. That's how old I am. And one day I'm jogging a trotter at Roosevelt Raceway on the training track, and I go past the gap, and there's the truant officer waving his hands at me and calling me over. And I'm like, "Oh, man, what am I going to do now?" So I went up alongside some of the guys, you know, I get to know them, and I said, "Man, that's the truant officer over there. I got to get out of here." He goes, "Look, take him around 2 more times and pull him up on the backside. I'll have somebody there to grab the horse and you jump over the fence." And that's exactly what it is.
That is a classic story. And back in the day, because that was what, in the late 60s, you know, that's how the racetrack was.
Yeah. What's that?
That's how the racetrack was. You know, you had guys like that and situations like that. Now, since you bring up the standardbreds and, you know, how you would jog them 2-3 miles, I've noticed when you train, you're with a lot of horses, you're kind of gentle. You take your time and you put a lot of slower miles into them rather than drill them. Is there, right, there a translation from the two sports?
You know, I think a lack of mileage is what gets horses hurt. And I think having that burning desire to win first time out with a horse, you know, makes you press a horse maybe harder than you want to. So I make it perfectly clear to my owners, your horse is going to run better second time out than he is first time out, because I get him to a point like 75-80% and I run him. I don't need to win first time out. I need to know that my 2-year-old is going to be a better horse second time out. That's important to me. And I probably have a much better statistic second time out. But I'm into long gallops. I'm into long works. I just think it keeps horses sounder. You know, like I said, I've worked for trainers. I worked for Laz Barrera. I worked for Lefty Nickerson, Scotty Schulhopper, all through the Brightview years. Not the Brightview years, the Harborview years. And, right, and you know, a lot, they really set a horse down. And you know, I've always been of the feeling that too many of them go out to the farm. So I'm kind of really in touch with trying to keep them going and get them to the races.
And I guess as a result, you understand the financial pressure on your owners.
Yes.
But you know, and that's so important.
Yeah, the biggest financial pressure you can have as an owner is vet bills and farm bills, and horses and earning anything.
Yeah. Now, speaking of owners, I've noticed over the last 5, 6, 7 years, you've really expanded your owner base.
Well, I'm one of those guys. I often said, you know, I'm a guy that goes into a gas station, fills up the car with gas, and I come out with a tank of gas and a guy that wants 10% of a horse. You know, that's my thing. I'm constantly promoting this game. So I have I have people in this game at a level that they can afford. And believe me, they're having a great time. I mean, we do have a lot of owners, and a lot of guys that own a small piece of horse, you know, guys that could never do this before any other way.
And a lot of those guys eventually become owners, right?
They do. They do, especially if you do some good with them. You know, some of them wind up hating you and get rid of you. That's the way it is. But, no, most, you know, if you give them a fair shot and I promote communication. I think you got to talk to your owners every day. They have a big expenditure here. I just think that you have to promote. So that's what it's all about. And I'm a very good communicator with the owners. They all know what's going on. No surprises.
Now, when you say you communicate, because that traditionally is what owners complain about the most, right? You know, they say,
right.
Oh, this guy, he's like an artist. He never responds to me.
Right. And I don't know why that is with my peers, but I have gotten a lot of owners over the years who have come to me saying, man, I can't even get a return phone call from my trainer. So, yeah, it's a strange thing, you know. I'm glad I'm, you know, maybe that's a positive for me and a negative for those guys, being a communicator.
Have you always been outgoing? Because I think, you know, some trainers hide behind the phone because they're, you know, shy or whatever. You always seem like a pretty outgoing guy.
I am. I love talking about horses. You know, I do clinics during the summer. I do confirmation clinics. I do all kinds of stuff. I love talking to people about horses. I bring in the public into my barn at Saratoga, and I give tours, and it's maybe an hour of a talk about horses, and I tell them about the horse's day and the horse's legs and therapy and, you know, the training, mental side of training and what we're trying to achieve. And I let them take selfies with the horses and everything else. And, you know, we've had a lot of good luck at bringing those people in. I don't know why Naira doesn't support it, but I said, the hell with Naira. I'm going to do it on my own. So I do it on my own. I bring people to the barn all the time and give tours of the barn and let them see the horses and get up close and personal.
Yeah. And I know you do a lot of video stuff as well.
I do. I have about 30 videos on YouTube. If you go to YouTube, Gary Contessa, some of it's just funny recollections from when I was a kid, and a lot of it is training. I mean, we have a feed video, we have a training video, a gate video, a guided tour of the Hall of Fame. You know, just all kinds of cool stuff. So, yeah, I enjoy it. I did when I was young, Dr. Hunt gave me a leg bone from a horse. And it's perfect. The knee is wired on, and the ankle is perfect, and the sesamoids are there in the foot. And one day I'm looking at that bone, and I'm like, man, this would make a great video. So I do a video on the inside of the horse's leg and the way the horse hits the ground and how if the blacksmith screws this, you know, a tenth of an inch this way or that way, it's very hard on the horse. And that video got over 50,000 hits on YouTube. And I got a call from, like, the Hong Kong Jockey Club thanking me for doing that. I got a call from a trainer in Dubai who now calls me all the time and asks me questions about things. So it was I love doing the videos. What I love more than anything is when somebody out of the blue, I'll be at a sale or I'll be just walking down the street and they say, man, I loved your video. I saw a video the other day. Man, at least that makes it all worthwhile.
You're like a modern day Jay Leno.
Yeah, right. Well, I really enjoy this business and I enjoy talking about it for sure. But I'm getting a little long in the tooth.
You've always had that enthusiasm, but are there some mornings when it's really tough?
Yes. Oh yeah. When a horse that you were counting on, you come in the morning and he's limping, or when it's, you know, 20 below zero and three exercise boys calling sick, and you know, this is a tough business. You get beat up by 1,400 pound horses constantly, and you've got to rely on the help. You've got to rely. There's so many ways to lose a race, and only one way to win a race. And there's so many hands on a horse, from the hot walker to the assistant to the foreman to the blacksmith to the vet. So many ways that you can screw up a good horse. So there are some very tough days. The toughest days for me is when a horse gets hurt or, you know, God forbid, has a, you know, a career-ending injury. That is very hard for me to stomach. That's the worst day of my life when that happens. It's just awful. So we do everything we can, everything, to try and make sure that never happens. And that includes we inspect every horse before they go to the track, and then at 10:30 when we're all done, we inspect every horse again 7 days a week. So hopefully that keeps us ahead of the curve and, you know, and keeps us at least going in the right direction and protecting the horses as well as we can.
One of the things I admired about you over the years is the fact that you've stayed in New York and you've not branched out to a million different places. And right. I guess that hands-on mentality that you're just talking about is one of the reasons for that.
I got to be in one place. Branching out never worked for me. We would have to do it on occasion when we did the New Jersey circuit. Because New Jersey circuit, every track is 2 hours away from the other one. So you'd be living at Monmouth, you're racing at Meadowlands, getting ready to go to Garden State, Atlantic City. So it's never worked for me. I need to be seeing these horses every day. And so that's why New York works very well for me.
And for a family man, it's important too because you have a home base.
Yes. And you know that horse trainers probably hold one of the highest percentages of divorce in this country too, because it's not easy for a non-horse person to understand their horse training husband. Me, I've gotten lucky. I've had the same wife, but it's very hard. I mean, it seems like every time we have tickets to a Broadway show, we get a colic or we get a horse that gets hurt or something like that. And you have to have the wife that's going to say, okay, go take care of business. We'll do it again another time.
So now, how long have you guys been married?
I've been married 24 years. This is my second wife, but I don't really remember the first one. The first one was one of my exercise girls, and it was fairly short-lived.
We were all younger then.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, getting back to Do It With Style, did you get to see that race or just hear the call just now? Well, that was the first three-year-old filly in the history of racing in the United States to win a grade one with no whip. I took the whip away from Shane Sellers the morning of the race. I did not want her hit with a whip, and she won that. She won that race by half a head, but she dug in. That was her thing. If you hit her, she would throw her ears back, swish her tail. I told Julie Crone that in the Comley, the race before the Ashland Stakes, and Julie Crone's three in front, and she hits her, and we wind up getting caught on the money after she slung her tail. And I really had to think about that for like a month. Was I going to take, did I have the guts to take the whip away from this filly in a grade one, bring her all the way to Keeneland and take away the whip? And the night before I said, yeah, I do. I'm going to do it. And the day of, the stewards at Keeneland must have asked me 10 times. They said, we want you to come in here and tell it yourself. They weren't even sure it was me on the phone. they must have asked me 10 times, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? And it wound up being the right thing.
Now, was she funny about the whip in the morning, or did you have an instinct?
Funny about the whip always. You could not whip her. And you can't tell a jockey to not whip a horse. This was Shane Sellers' first grade one win. And he said to me in the winner's circle, he said, Gary, it's a damn good thing you didn't give me a whip because I sure as shit would have won it. He only won by half a head.
Yeah, no, it was game effort down the lane.
Yeah.
But that was the whip situation. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I said that was her, rock solid, and that was for Leonard Green, who's just, you know, he's been such a incredible owner all his life. I mean, you remember when he had Walter Reese, he had like 100 yep. horses in training, and then Alan Seawald, and I got him after he got mad at Alan Seawald, and I've had him ever since. So I have my share for him, that's for sure. I have 8 or 10 horses at all times.
No, Leonard's been great for a lot of trainers in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, and you've got to give the guy credit for staying local also.
Yeah.
And staying loyal to the program.
Well, he's going to Santa Anita next week.
I know you got him next week, right?
Yeah, we got in. We were lucky enough to get in. I lobbied pretty good to get that horse in there. I mean, first of all, his first race, he runs second to Green Light Go on the dirt, who's arguably one of the top five horses in the country on the dirt. Then he comes back in an off-the-turf where he wins. Then he wins the Skidmore Stakes on the turf. And in the Futurity, which was a win and you're in, I thought he was a cinch. And he comes out of the gate, he hyperextends, and he rips both shoes off coming out of the gate. Manny Franco tells me the shoe went right past his head. I'm like, and the horse never gave up. He got beat 4.5 lengths and never gave up and was sore as a boil the next day having no shoes on with the pounding he took on the turf course. But we fixed him. We got him the therapy he needed. We fixed his feet. I worked him last Saturday. He worked great. And he's going to work again this Saturday and fly to Santa Anita on Sunday.
It's got to be exciting for you.
Yeah,
to just be there. But also, obviously, with the work that you've done on this horse, it's got to be a great feeling to see something come your way.
Yeah, you know, when I was at the sale at Gulfstream Park, and Len Green came up to me and he said, Gary, we just bought a horse back through the ring. I'm going to send him to you if that's okay. And I'm like, oh, yeah, great. Who's he by? He goes, American Pharoah. I'm like, oh, man. How nice is this? Talk about being in the right place at the right time.
Well, you know, that's part of it, but you also have that relationship with Len.
I do. I do, and he's a great, great man. He is so benevolent. He's just an incredible guy. He's got so much going on, and he's the most benevolent guy you ever want to meet.
Yep. I've known him almost as long as I've known you, and it's a great family. They're good people.
John,
this horse,
they're all so good. Daryl, Debbie, the whole family, Lois, I mean, the sweetest people in the world.
Now, this horse, another miracle, you mentioned he's an American Pharoah, and you got him going on the grass. Is that because of a foot issue? Or?
No. He won a stake on the grass at Saratoga after he broke his maiden on the dirt. But you got to understand, you know, I'm in Saratoga, my head is spinning, I got so much work to do. And I win the race with another miracle, and somebody, and one of the press writers says to me, hey, Gary, can you believe that's the first American Pharoah anywhere to win on the dirt? I'm like, you got to be kidding me. He goes, no. He goes, the first 8 American Pharoahs to win all won on the grass.
Right.
So I'm like, So I'm looking at the stake book, and there's 2 options, 5.5 on the turf in the Skidmore or the hopeful. And I didn't think off that win he was ready for the hopeful 7 furlongs. So I just went for the 5.5 turf with the knowledge that that horse was throwing turf horses. And sure enough, I worked him on the grass at Saratoga, and he liked flew over it. I loved his work. They just have a way. They change their action. They're so comfortable when you get one that really likes it. And he was amazing. So the other thing with this horse is, and he's not a big horse. If you happen to see him, he's a small in stature horse. He's got a tremendous heart, but he's not a big strapping horse. He's a very small horse. He's like 15 hands.
So, but he's very athletic, though. You know, when you look at him, he's like a cat.
He is the perfect example of, it doesn't matter how big they are. It matters how much desire they have. And he desires to win. He's a good colt.
Well, you're going to go out there, I guess, on Sunday. No, you're going to stay out there for a few days?
I'm going to fly out Monday and stay all week.
Great. Good. So when you're gone, you've got people that have worked for you for years. Do you want to mention their names? Because you've had a good group for years.
I have Amira Chichokli. She's been with me for about 8 years. She's a rider and assistant trainer. And I have Juan Gonzalez, who's been with me about 15 years. And he's just an assistant trainer. I mean, he's my other assistant trainer. I mean, we refer to him as the number one assistant trainer so that we can avoid arguments. But he's been with me a long time, and he knows what I like and what I don't like. And that's that, you know, he thinks like I do. So I like that. And then down in Florida, I have John Diaz, who everybody loves. He comes up for Saratoga, and he does whatever we do in Florida for the winter. I'm going to send a couple of Mr. Green's turf-only horses to Tampa this year. And I'm going to give John Diaz down there a shot to win some races.
Just well, that's a great turf course over there.
What's that?
That Tampa course is a great turf course.
Oh, man. I love the track. I love the owners. It's just Mrs. Thayer's so nice, and this racing secretary is so nice. You know what I said to myself? I said, I go to Gulfstream every winter with, you know, a handful of horses, maybe two grooms and six to eight horses. And I lose money every single day. If I'm going to lose money this year, I'm going to lose money at Tampa. It's such a nice place. It'll be my first foray there, although I did one in the Tampa Bay Derby, you know, way early in my career and finished second with Abel Buck. But that was my only action at Tampa was that horse.
No, I think you'll like it there. It's, you know, that old school kind of racetrack that you and I came up with.
Yeah, I like it.
And it's the horses seem to do real well there.
Yep, I agree.
So let's transition for a second, because one of the things that, you know, you talked about how you take care of the horses and how you look after them, but you're also involved in something called the Acceler Fund.
Yes.
And that goes hand in hand with your mentality of the horses under your shed row. You know, you want to make sure that you're doing the best for them. Tell us a little bit about the Acceler Fund.
Well, we all know. You know, for those that don't know, Excella was a horse that went to, I believe, Sweden, and he did not work out. I mean, that Excella is the horse that beat Affirmed and Seattle Slew here in one of the greatest races ever. He came from way back. The day that Affirmed saddle slipped and Seattle Slew and Affirmed went like 109 the first three quarters. And Excella come from the clouds. He won. He was subsequently sold, sent to Sweden and wound up in a slaughterhouse. So I am very much anti-slaughter. I mean, I just can't believe that I've been training horses my whole life and we had no visible, you know, coming up in the 70s, the 80s, 90s, it wasn't a mindset. Hey, where does this horse go after I give him away to somebody? Because that person can't afford him and he throws him in a kill pen. So now there is such a consciousness about horses and having a career after racing that it's something that I wanted to get involved with. Now, they called me and they said, we need a president. And this was about 15 years ago. And I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And I spent 10, 12 years as president for the Acceler Fund. And what we do is our core is the horses that retire injured, and they were great race horses, but they retire with an ankle that's not going to make them the greatest riding horse or a suspensory or a broken knee or whatever. And we call them racing's warriors. And that's the kind of horse that we're looking to retire and carry for the rest of his life. So we get a grant from Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. We have fundraisers and whatnot, the Acceler Fund, and mainly we get our money from the backs of moms and pops all over the country. That's like people send us 10, 15 bucks. It's like, you know, you get that thing in the mail and somebody sends you $10 or $15 and you're thrilled. So that's the Acceler Fund. We have 34 satellite farms that look after upwards of 150 horses for us.
I didn't realize that there were that many horses in the program.
Oh yeah, and as a matter of fact, you guys saw the movie Seabiscuit, right? The horse that starred in that movie is one of ours.
So that's pretty cool.
We lent him to the movie people for that because he was a sound retired horse, and he had such a good mind that he was so cool about everything. We thought he'd be a great work for that part, and he did that part. He wound up becoming a movie star. So people go to that farm just to see him.
Well, that's excellent. We actually have a couple of former New York racehorses here at our farm. Matter of fact, one that you probably remember, Teocek, who banged around there for years. And He's actually replacing my dog as a puppy, I think. But he's great. And, you know, it's great that we're able to give these horses a forever home, as they say, without sounding corny. Gary, I got to let you go because I've held you here for 40 minutes, and I know you want to see how that horse cools out.
Yeah, he's walking past me.
We'd love to have you back on the show, and best of luck on next week in the Breeders' Cup, and send my regards to Leonard.
Anytime, man. I love talking to you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
All right.
We'll take a little break, and on the other side, we're going to have Ursel Ellis with us.
They are superstar athletes, but they don't ask for more money or go on strike. They bring their best every time they play. They are great thoroughbreds, retired at Old Friends.
And here's commentator turning for home in the Whitney with a three-length lead. And here's commentator to win the Whitney again. And boy, he did it with some front-running style today.
All commentator wants is a peppermint and to hang out with a couple of his pals, like Eclipse Award winners Hidden Lake and Sunshine Forever, or even a Breeders' Cup champ.
Prize the surging Sierra Roberto toward the inside. A driving finish in the turf. And here's the wire. And it is prized.
Many of the past superstars of our sport are still running around. So come visit them at Old Friends in Georgetown, Kentucky, or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Hey, Ursel, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Les. Appreciate it.
Great to have you on. And, you know, for those folks that don't know, Ursel Ellis, first of all, he's like a family member to me because every Saturday for the last probably 15 years, I've been listening to the guy on the radio, he and Jackie, and it's not a Saturday morning without Ursel and Jackie. So we want to thank you for that.
Thank you very much. I wondered who my other listener was, and I didn't know it was in Florida.
Yeah, it's you want to hear a funny story? I just mentioned to Gary Contessa that we have a horse on the farm who won a bunch of races in New York. And the first day that we got him in on a Saturday, and he came to the barn about 6 o'clock in the morning. And we've got one of those little Amazon dots in the barn to listen to your show. Well, the horse is settling in. And, you know, at the beginning of your show, you have the call to the post. Well, this son of a buck's ears went straight up. He thought he was back at the racetrack. And so he's now an Ursel listener also.
Well, he is. Horses have great memories, you know. They don't forget too much. And I've seen that happen before. I was used to train, and there was a local program on at the time, and I was leading the horse down to the track, and that program came on, and the bugle blew a call to post, and he did exactly the same thing. If you say he stopped dead in his tracks and looked,
That's so exactly what he did. His eyes got clear and he focused.
You used
to train for many years, right?
Well, yeah, I just trained my own. You know, we poor folks. And I bought four mares off the track when I trained the progeny, the foals out of those four mares. And, you know, they didn't have a whole lot of pedigree. I bought them because they could run, they were athletes. And we did very well with three of them. One of them wasn't worth a ham sandwich. But we'd sell the ones, we'd get them ready to run and sell them, you know. And we would train the leftovers. We did it for 20, 25 years, something like that. It didn't make a whole lot of money, but had a lot of fun. And it schooled me pretty good for gambling. I'm not much of a gambler because I lost so much money on my own horses. But we had a lot of fun back in 90. And we raced mostly around Kentucky. We trained here at the Thoroughbred Center out on, you know, here in I live in Bergen County, but the Thoroughbred Center is 15-minute drive from where I live, close to Lexington.
Now, for a lot of people that are in our generation, that was built by the Murdy brothers, right?
The Murdy brothers? No. It was founded by Neil Pessin. Neil's dad, Arnold Pessin. And he had a partner, the guy that owned Kaled, you know, that stood Kaled and on Brick Candy Spots and all those horses. You know, he was a partner founding that place. It was founded back in the 60s. And it's Kingdom owns it now. And it's a wonderful facility. Most of the trainers there are local people that, like us, that I was on the track for a while, but found out, you know, as I kind of got married, and that got me off the track right away. So, but anyway, so we raised our own and raced. Stay here the year round, you know. Races, they have year round racing here. In Kentucky, as you probably know.
Right. But, now, you mentioned that you're local people, and this gives me an opportunity to kind of move to the book that you just wrote, because it's kind of it's really, really interesting. And let's talk about that if we could, because it brings back kind of the history of the sport in Kentucky and gives a real feel for how it was.
You mean my book?
Your book.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it was kind of a memoir. You know, it's no big deal. I never in this world thought I was going to write a book. But, you know, I've been doing that show that I'm doing now still for 25 years. And I get on there and tell a few stories, you know, and about old-time horses and things. And some of them might have been true even. And But people started... You know, why don't you write a book? You know, and I never thought much about it. Finally, my wife, Jackie, got on me about it. And I didn't want to sleep on the couch, so I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. And, yeah, it's selling pretty good. I was shocked that it's selling. I don't know where you can get it from Florida, but, well, you got to go to Amazon, I guess.
And we've got it at our tack shop. You know, we have a tack shop called Racetrack Supply. And we've actually sold a few books. And if somebody goes on to Racetrack Supply and buys one of the books, we're donating $5 for each book that we sell to old friends. So,
Michael Bloom's on the show every week with me.
I know. Matter of fact, my wife and I argue because I say he has a Boston accent and she says he doesn't.
He had a what for that? Now you have to slow down a little bit.
Has a Boston accent. And she says, "Nah, he lost that, but I think he still has it."
Well, anyway, yes, I love Michael, and he does. I don't think there's anybody in the world that done it except Michael. What he did was that, you know. I thought he was out of his mind when he told me what he was going to do, you know. But I put him on the air, and he started coming on the show every week, and he thought it helped him a little bit. So I hope it did. I'd like to feel like it did, you know, help him get the word out. Actually, he's been there. I'm sure. Have you been to Old Friends?
No, you know what? I've never been down. Every time we go to Kentucky, we never get there, and we probably should.
Oh, absolutely. They got the Derby winners and Belmont Stakes winners and don't have a Triple Crown winner yet, but, you know, maybe someday a Gilded will win it and they'll get it. You know, I doubt seriously if Justify will end up there. But anyway, they take such good care of them. It's a big, big tourist attraction. People come from all over to look at these horses. It's amazing what he's done with that.
No, he's promoted it so well, and it's become the standard for everybody else.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, he's, of course, you know, aftercare now is a big thing. And I've got four horses on our farm here that I'm trying to outlive. The youngest one's 21, and the oldest one's 27. And two of them I trained. One was a rescue, and then the fourth is a mare that my mother that Jackie used to fox hunt. But anyway, I'm looking out the window here now, Adam. And they're out there grazing. Grass is good here, although we've had a dry summer, but still, it's hard to keep grass down in Kentucky. It had a rain, you know, and now it's all green again. So thank the good Lord for that.
Yeah. The four that you have, you know, one of the things that I like most about listening to your show is your understanding of pedigree. So the mares that you bought, were they based on your philosophy or?
Well, I write all on commercials, and I've got some great sponsors. I've got sponsors. I used to do a race results show here. I did that for 50 years, believe it or not. I started doing it in 1960. It was a 15-minute show, and I would get the national race results off an old Associated Press teletype machine, you know, rip them off and look at my racing form, which was you could afford at that time.
Right.
And you know, get the race results, and all of them I could get in. And would write my commercials for that, and a lot of my sponsors have been with me for, 25 years or something like that. You know what I mean? Forever. You know, Airdrie Stud was one of my first sponsors. Burton Jones is a wonderful person, and folks over here at Claiborne, and you know, people like that. And when you write your commercials, and as long as I've been doing, you do your homework, you know. It's a whole lot easier now with computers, you know. As a matter of fact, I quit doing the race results show because, you know, people go about 10 years ago, I think it was, a 15-minute show, and because the computer was just kind of making me obsolete. So, but I was also at that time doing the two-hour show every Saturday morning, so.
The two-hour show is like a piece of gold, not to embarrass you. But, you know, we do a show, lots of people do a show. Nobody does a show like you do. And it, as a horseman, I appreciate it. And, you know, I'll thank you publicly for that because you're keeping the sport alive the right way.
Well, thank you so much for that. You know, I've been around. I'm 88 years old. And, I've seen a lot of racing and, you know, a lot of great horses and lots of not so great. And as you notice in my book, I write about some horses that nobody heard about but me. You know,
but that was the nice thing about the book, because everybody writes about the same horses over and over again.
Well, that's true. But I thought some of these old champions, like, you know, great trivia question would be, who was the champion trio in 1944? And I had to look it up. It turned out to be a horse named Bigenity. So I said, well, I'm going to see if I can write a little bit about Bigenity, which I did. And, you know, horses like that, some great horses. I grew up with Man of War, you know. My dad.
Now, the section you did on Man of War in the book, I thought was great.
Well, thank you. My dad put the first halter on him in 1917. He was working for Aldous Belmont. That was his first job in the horse business. And I saw the horse first when I was about 6 years old. And my dad took me to see him. He told me at the time, said, you take a good look at this horse, boy, because you'll never see another one like him. And he was right. I never have. And I grew up on Dixiana Farm, which is just a 20-25 minute bike ride, you know, wasn't much traffic out on the roads at that time, and from far where Man of War was, and I would drive over, and I got to know Mr. Harbert and his groom, and he was a wonderful man, and my dad just told me to go over and keep my mouth shut, and call him Mr. Harbert because he was a great horseman, and maybe I'd grow up and be like him someday. And consequently, I know I've heard a lot of these tales, and as I say, some of them might have been true. And
actually, I was talking to Steve Coffin the other day, and you know, he does some work over at Dixiana, and I sent him a copy of the book because he really didn't know about Man of War's history on the farm, and so it's great that we're able to share some of that stuff.
Who is this now?
Steve Coffin.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The jockey.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But so he's doing some work over there, and I mentioned to him the book, and I'm sure he's enjoying it. Now,
well, good. Well, thank you.
The book talks about horses like Man of War and, you know, some of the others. But who are some of your personal favorites? Because I know you've got to latch on to some horses in all these years.
Well, yeah, most of them, you know, the old Dixiana horses was Manahara, was a 10 and 2-year-old of 19. She was full the same year as I was. Dixiana had 3 stakes-winning fillies that year, 1931. And I was full in 1931. My dad used to tell me it was definitely a filly year. But Manahara was always one of my favorites. And, of course, her son, Spy Song, who was a stud. And my dad loved Spy Song. He was to this day, one of the fastest horses I've ever seen come out of starting gate. I mean, he would make a good start look bad. And quarter horses, people were dying to breed to him. And his dad would get all kinds of calls from out west that wanted to breed the Spy Song, you know. And but he was a very successful son of Balladeer, and the second best, well, Balladeer was a sire size. Double J was better size than Spy Song, but the two of them were excellent. Double J, of course, stood over at the favorite farm, top sizes. But so he was one of my favorites. I've had some favorites down through the years. I got to see Swap run out in California. I saw him set a world record.
Now, you were in the service out there, right?
Yeah, I was there. And the first time I went to Florida was the 1950, the winter of 19, fall of 56, and I was there for 1957. Crop of 3-year-olds, and I saw General Duke set a world record in the Florida Derby, beating Bolger and those horses, you know. That was my estimation, and I'd be glad to argue with you about this, but I think that was the best crop of 3-year-olds in history. And it was Roundtable and Gallant Man, and even, you know, Federal Hill was a brilliant miler, and Clem, who was a giant killer, ended up beating Roundtable 4 times, ended up beating him at equal weights. And Vertex, who was went on to be, he was a little slow developing, but he was a wonderful handicap horse, the best in the East when he was a 4 and 5-year-old. Mathco Roundtable was in the West just most of the time, but, you know, and Vertex was a beautiful horse.
And they became great sires, too. You know, they've stayed in the pedigree for decades and decades.
Yeah, well, of course, Bo Ruler is top sire 6 times. And that was, you know, that's still a record. I think he had to go back to Starshoot around the turn. Excuse me, around the turn of the century out at Hamburg Place. But to get close to him, but Bo Ruler was a I got to see him, of course, after he went stud. Just people over Claiborne are so nice, you know. You go over there and they show you around, you know. And you need to come up there and we'll have a tour.
You know what? My wife, Alora, said one of her goals is to have lunch with you and Jackie. So we're going to have to do that.
Well, there's a wonderful little place right here in Paris that I meet with Dr. Copeland, Dr. Bob Copeland. I don't know if you know Bob.
Yeah. I met him a long, long time ago.
Well, he's, you know, a world-famous veterinarian. He's retired, and he is 94, and I'm 88, and I love to tell him that I love to hang around with my elders. So, but he's a wonderful man, and, of course, he was a great veterinarian. You talk about some tales. He's the one should write a book. I mean, he can keep you in stitches with some of these tales that he talked about. We have lunch together over here. It's a little restaurant in Paris called Lille's, and they just opened for breakfast and lunch, closed at 3 o'clock. And it's you know, it's great food and great company. Paris Kentucky is the friendliest little town you've ever been in your life. I mean, you're going there and you can't go to the post office without completely, you know, everybody was smiling and saying good morning, or, you know, whether you know them or not. You know, it's a wonderful town. It's a great place to live. I'm blessed to be living here, to tell you the truth. Got some good neighbors, too.
Hopefully we get to get together with you guys.
And when you come to
my producer's is telling me that it's almost time for Happy Trails. So, okay. Ursel, as always, you end your show with Happy Trails. We end it with Born to Run. But as always, it's a pleasure talking with you. Please send my regards to Jackie. And
all right.
Anything we can do to help move that book, we're all for it. And I keep on bugging Michael to bug you to do a second edition of that Joe Palmer CD.
Oh, I've still got some of those.
That's my favorite CD in the history of the world.
Well, my goodness. Okay, well, appreciate that, too. So, but anyway, I'm serious. So give me a call and it's next time you're in Kentucky, and we'll take a tour of Cleveland. And I'd like to go out and see Arrogate. I haven't had a chance.
I'll be more than happy to take you.
Anytime. Come on up.
Okay, send my regards. And, folks, thanks for joining us today on the Equisport Radio Network. We'll be back with you shortly. And Don Newsom, thank you out there in California. We appreciate your help at the control panel. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.